together in the Word of God, in the Scriptures of the Old Testament. We are studying some of the prophecies of the coming Christ in the Old Testament, and we come this morning to Isaiah. We're reading in from chapter 8 and verse 16 into the ninth chapter, which is the chapter dealing with Emmanuel, God with us. We really have two scriptures. In Isaiah chapter 9, the prophet sees that the coming one will be the governor of the universe. And later on in Daniel chapter 7, we see God handing over a kingdom to his son. But we read in from Isaiah 8 and verse 16. You'll see that it's a time of great darkness for the people of God. And so God counsels Isaiah to take aside the true believers and teach them the word in the darkness. Bind up the testimony, seal the teaching among my disciples. I will wait for the Lord, who is at present hiding his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. Behold, I and the children, that's to say the true believers, whom the Lord has given me, are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. Verse 19 says that in this time of confusion and darkness, people were going to seances for guidance. And when they say to you, consult the mediums and the wizards, the spirits who chirp and mutter in the darkness at seances, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the teaching and to the testimony, surely for this word which they speak, there is no dawn. They will pass through the land greatly distressed and hungry. And when they are hungry, they will be enraged, and they will curse their king and their God. And they will look to the earth, but behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun in the north and the land of Naphtali in the north. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light, and those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. Thou hast multiplied the nation, thou hast increased its joy. They rejoice before thee as with joy at the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, thou hast broken, as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of his peace, there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. And the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. And in the book of Daniel, which is an allied passage, chapter 7, where Daniel sees a vision of Christ receiving a kingdom from his Father. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 9. And verse 9, yes, Daniel 7 and 9. As I looked in my vision, thrones were placed, and one who was the Ancient of Days took his seat. His raiment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. Verse 13. And so I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like the Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one that shall not be destroyed. Amen. May God add a blessing to the reading of his word. To his name be the honor and the praise. Now you're in our series of studies on basic Christian teaching. We are now thinking about the question of the coming one in the Old Testament. You see, the Old Testament is full of promises of a coming Messiah. And in the 1600 years between Abraham and the birth of Jesus, the burning question in men's hearts was, what will this coming Messiah be like? What will the coming one be like when he arrives? And so throughout the Old Testament, you have a series of portraits of the coming Christ, snapshots and studies and pictures of the coming one, the one who was to come. In the first of these studies, we had a look at the first promise of the coming one in the Garden of Eden. And the assurance there was given that when he came, he would be human, the seed of the woman. He would be like one of us. He would be able to understand our problems and our difficulties. When he came, he would be a human Christ. He would be a human Savior. And alongside that, in the garden, there was the promise that the coming one would crush the head of the serpent. He was coming to deal with the devil and all his works. The seed of the woman shall bruise the serpent's head. And that is sometimes called by scholars the proto-evangel, or the first sounding out of the good news of Christ. In the second of these studies, in the coming one, we saw the prophet Balaam looking into the future in a trance. And he saw something different about the coming one. He saw that the coming one was to be a guide for men through the confusion and the perplexities of life. He said, "There shall come a star out of Jacob." And stars in the ancient world were associated with guidance on long journeys. The wise men came to Bethlehem, and they were guided by a star. when the Apostle Paul sailed for Rome, the sailors taking him there steered the ship by the stars. And so Christ comes to us as a guide to take us safely home. And Balaam also saw that as well as being a star to guide us, he would also be a king to rule over us. Balaam said, a scepter shall rise in Israel. When he comes to men's hearts, he comes to rule over their hearts and their lives. When he comes, he will have the lordship and the homage, the majesty, and all these things that are due to a king. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise in Israel. The coming one will be a guide and a king. And today, we come to another picture of the coming one. Isaiah tells us that when he comes, he will be a world ruler. That is the picture that you find in Isaiah and in Daniel. He comes to receive a kingdom. It is the year 732 BC. And the people of God are reaping bitter harvests of judgment for their unbelief and their infidelity to God. And it seems as if the nation is falling to pieces. Politically, it's falling to bits. Assassination after assassination, government after government, policy after policy, and nothing seems to work in the year 732 BC. Socially, morally, spiritually, the people of God was falling to pieces. And in the midst of this bedlam, the people were turning to mediums. They were trying to get counsel from the dead for the living. And it is in this darkness, a darkness, I'm bound to say, not unlike the moral and spiritual darkness of our own generation, it is in this darkness that Isaiah saw a child who would be born, a child with the wonderful name, a child who would one day rule the universe. The government shall be upon his shoulder. And Daniel re-echoes the message of Isaiah much later on in the Babylonian captivities, where he sees the Most High, the Ancient of Days, giving a kingdom to the Son of Man. I saw in the night visions, behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like the Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him, and to him, the Son of Man, was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one which shall not be destroyed. And in a sense, our text for this morning is that verse from Isaiah. The government shall be upon his shoulder. Isaiah and Daniel agree that when the child comes, the government shall be upon his shoulder. Now, can I ask you, what do you make of that proposition? That the government is on the shoulders of Christ. Well, I think the first thing we would all surely say is, if the government is on the shoulders of Christ, it certainly is not obvious. If Christ rules the world, and if the rule and the authority in the world are Christ's, and if the government of the world's affairs is on the shoulders of Christ, then it is not immediately apparent. In fact, there is very little evidence in the world today to suggest that the government is on Christ's shoulders. In fact, There is much to suggest that the government of the world lies on very different shoulders indeed. The men in Washington and Peking and Moscow, surely the government of the world is on their shoulders. Or if you go to the Stock Exchange in London, to the world of high finance, or if you pass amongst people who manipulate the world's money markets, if you have a chat with the gnomes of Zurich, and those who speculate with money on Wall Street, New York, surely these are the men who rule the world. Or you could have a casual chat with an Arab oil sheikh holding the world to ransom with a wee drappy of oil, and you would be entitled to say, surely the government is not on the shoulders of Christ. The government is on the shoulders of these men. And if you move from that world into the inner recesses of history, there is much to suggest that Christ is not the ruler of this world. Would you care to listen to this catalogue of suffering? Alexander Ginsberg, member of the Russian Orthodox Church, arrested in 1977, held in prison without trial for 15 months. He was eventually brought to court and charged with anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda, and he was sentenced to 8 years in a labor camp. Anatoly Sharansky, a Jew, held in prison for 4 months without trial and charged with treason, sentenced to 3 years in prison and 10 years in a Soviet labor camp. Viktoras Petkus, a Roman Catholic from Lithuania, arrested in 1977, kept in prison for over a year without trial. He was charged with anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison, 7 years in a labor camp, and 5 years in exile. Peter Vins, member of the Baptist Church, arrested in 1978 and charged with parasitism, sentenced to a year in a Soviet labor camp. Robert Nazarian, member of the Armenian Apostolic Church, arrested in 1977. He is still in prison and has not yet been brought to trial. If the government is on the shoulders of Christ, it is certainly not obvious. A few months ago, communists took over the government of Afghanistan. In the first 2 days of the revolution, 10,000 people were killed. The Prime Minister's wife, his 3 sons, their 3 wives, and all the grandchildren were shot in front of the Prime Minister's eyes. And last of all, the communists shot him. So that the last thing he saw was the death of his wife, his 3 sons, his 3 daughters-in-law, and all his grandchildren. Last year in the Soviet Union, 1,018 members of the Baptist Church were arrested. 20 of them died in prison or were tortured to death, and children have been taken away from 45 Christian families and put into homes. The number of the members of the Orthodox Church in Russia who are in jail is so large that it cannot now be counted. And in case you think I'm being a bit hard on the left wing regimes. You could go to a right-wing regime like the fascists who run the Argentine just now. You could have a little tour through the torture chambers and the interrogation rooms of a right-wing government and ask the suffering people if they believed that the government of the world was on the shoulders of Christ. I see from the news that President Carter says that America reaffirms its friendship with the Shah of Persia. Well, I would not care to have the Shah of Persia as my friend. Admittedly, Persia's in a bad way, and admittedly, the Reds are making the most of it. But did you know that the reign of the Shah of Persia has been characterized by the utmost brutality and persecution? Did you know that everyone who dies, dies by personal order of the Shah? Did you know that everyone who is interrogated and tortured is interrogated and tortured on the personal orders of the Shah himself? Now, if you look at all that world of pain, do you get the impression that the government is on Christ's shoulders? Well, of course, the gospel of Christ has an answer to these questions. You see, the New Testament speaks about the mystery of the kingdom. And that word mystery is a very special word. In fact, it's a Greek word. When you use the word mystery, you are speaking Greek. But it does not mean in that world what mystery means to us today. Nowadays, when we speak of a mystery, we speak of something that is utterly unintelligible. You know, you shrug your shoulders and you say, oh, well, I canna mak heed nor tail o't. It's a complete mystery to me. Or, that sermon today, I'm completely baffled. It was a mystery to me. Something you could never understand. But the word mysterion, mystery in Greek, it meant an open secret. The outsider couldn't see the secret because he's on the outside and he's not in the know. But once you become in the know and once you are admitted to the inner secret, then the mystery becomes an open secret. And that's why the New Testament speaks of the mystery of the kingdom. It's an open secret to those who are on the inside. But from the outside, you see nothing but chaos and meaninglessness. I'm bound to say here that I find this idea of the secrecy of the kingdom immensely appealing. I wonder if you'll admit that there is a great interest in secrecy in the human heart. There's a great love of secrecy and privacy in the heart of man. You can sometimes see it in children. Have you ever noticed that little children like to have a private wee place of their own? Even a cardboard box. And only his toys go into that box. Or a private little cupboard. Or a private little hidey hole where they like to withdraw to and be safe and secure. There's a great love of secrecy in the human heart. I can recall from my boyhood days, not so very long ago, the fun we used to have constructing secret dens in the garden. And the dens were heavily camouflaged so that from the outside you didn't think there was anything there at all. But on the inside, there we were, snug and secure, and we could take our pals in to drink Bar's Iron Brew, And greatly daring, we would smoke cinnamon stick and be sick. Love of secrecy. And how children love to withdraw into something that's private like that. And even out on the braes round Portsoy as lads, we used to dig holes in the earth like cavemen and snuggle into the holes and put a roof over the hole and cover it with turf so that from the outside you'd never think there was anything going on there. And it's like that with the kingdom of Christ. From the outside, you can't see it. If you are an outsider to the kingdom today, you can't see what's going on inside. It's only when you come inside that you understand the kingdom. And that, I'm sure, is why Jesus said, "Except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom." He cannot see. He's standing outside the den. He's outside the private, secret place. He is outside the hidden place. And he cannot see because he has not been born again. And until a man is born again, he cannot see how the government can be on the shoulders of Christ in spite of Russia and the dissidents and the torture chambers and the psychiatric hospitals, in spite of the fascists in the Argentine, in spite of the Shah of Persia. If you are not born again, you cannot see why the government is on the shoulders of Christ, because the mystery of the kingdom is an open secret to the insiders only. The rest don't see it. They don't know, they don't understand, they don't appreciate what it's all about, because they're blind and they're deaf and they're dead and they don't understand, and their fundamental need is to be born again of the Spirit of God. Let me move on. Firstly, it's not obvious that the government is on his shoulder. Secondly, there is a mystery in the kingdom. Now, points 3 and 4 follow from that very quickly. Christians must think in terms of the hidden king and the hidden kingdom. Let me speak about the hidden king. It certainly was true of Christ's birth. The prophet Micah said that the governor of God's people would be born at Bethlehem. But when the governor came, how many people recognized him? Only a few spotted that the king had come. I think that Wesley puts it very finely in his Christmas hymn, "Hark the Herald Angels Sing." He speaks about the hidden king, and he says, "Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see." Veiled in flesh. Now, something that is veiled is at least partly hidden. The king is a hidden king. You find the same idea in the words of another Christmas carol, "O little town of Bethlehem, no ear may hear his coming, but in this world of sin, where meek souls will receive him, still the dear Christ enters in. No ear may hear his coming." When the king comes, it is a private, hidden, veiled thing. And what was true of his birth was also true of his life. Even in life, men did not recognize that the governor had come. They said, "Is not this Joseph's son? Is not this the carpenter's son? And are not all his brothers and sisters here with us? Isn't this Joseph's son?" You see, the king had come, but his kingship was veiled, and it was the same in his death on the cross. His kingship was veiled. The Apostle Paul says, "If they had known who he really was, they would not have crucified the Prince of Glory." In birth, in life, and in death, Jesus is the hidden king. And because he is a hidden king, his kingdom is very often a hidden kingdom. wonder if you've noticed how many of Christ's parables were about hidden things. A sower went forth to sow. The seed is buried, hidden. Pearl of great price was lost in some oyster until the oyster was fished up and the pearl was brought to light. But until the pearl was brought to light, it was a hidden thing. Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. There were no banks in those days. So if you wanted to store money, you just went into the middle of a field, dug a hole and put the money there, hoping that you might remember where the field was. The kingdom is like treasure hidden. A grain of mustard seed, hidden. The lost coin, the wifey who lost the coin. The lost sheep, hidden, lost, until it's found. And I'm sure it's not accidental that Christ is always speaking about the hiddenness of his reign. The government is upon his shoulders. In all your problems and your perplexities and your difficulties, in all your anxieties and your distresses, amongst the nations of the earth, Jesus Christ reigns. But his reign is veiled for the moment. The hidden king has a hidden kingdom for the moment. Why do I say for the moment? Well, I say it because it will not always be like this. The day is coming when the king will come in person. And the kingdom that is now hidden will become a manifest kingdom then. And when he comes, it will then be obvious to everyone that the government is upon his shoulders. For every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that he is Lord. And so Jesus Christ comes twice. He comes now to your heart and to your life. Jesus Christ can come to you now personally. You can become a child of God's kingdom now. Jesus Christ can begin his reign in you now. You can have him on the throne of your heart now. But that's not the end of the story, because the king is coming, and the real Christmas hasn't happened yet. The real Christmas will happen when the kingdom comes, and the kingdom comes when the king comes. It's a thought that is captured very beautifully in the carol Once in Royal David's City. The first few verses are about Bethlehem, but the last two verses are about the king who's still to come, and our eyes at last shall see him. And that's why Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4 speaks about the kingdom and the appearing of Christ in one breath. The kingdom and the appearing of Christ. When he appears, the kingdom comes. But the only guarantee that you will share in that day, with its feasting and its merriment and its mirth and its joy and its glory, the only guarantee that you will share in that day is the surrender of your heart and your life and your home to Christ's government and lordship. Now, for the government shall be upon his shoulder. Amen.